You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a legal and political fight over student loan forgiveness has left millions in limbo. 1A's series Life and Debt looks at its impact and the plan to restart federal student loan repayments. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Daniel Penny is facing charges of second-degree manslaughter after killing Jordan Neely on a New York City subway earlier this month. Police say Neely, who was homeless, was behaving erratically but hadn't assaulted anyone before Penny put him in a chokehold and ultimately killed him. In addition to arguments about the specifics of the incident, the event has drawn attention to wider issues of homelessness and the way homeless people are treated, viewed, and talked about. Our next guest says that media portrayals of homelessness in our news and our popular culture can influence our real-world behavior towards unhoused people, even to the point of violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you usually see homelessness depicted in the media? Where do you think we could do better? Have you yourself experienced homelessness at some point in your life? How did you see people seeing you differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Whitney Gent is an assistant professor of rhetoric and civic engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. She got her doctorate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her research focuses on rhetorics of poverty and homelessness. So welcome back to Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Now, whether it's in the media or our day-to-day lives, where do you see people getting it wrong when it comes to the way we talk about homelessness?
Well, whether we're talking about entertainment media or we are talking about news media, the representations of homelessness that we see are of homeless people as criminals, homeless people as folks who have made bad decisions to get themselves to the places where they are. Oftentimes an immediate assumption that is made about homeless people based on political rhetoric and media rhetoric is that they are mentally ill or dealing with issues related to addiction, which is not necessarily the case. All of these things collectively give media viewers and just plain citizens who are involved in their communities ideas about homelessness that make homeless people feel like a threat.
And it seems like I see two different approaches to talk about homelessness. One is to talk about a social problem of homelessness as the issue. Another is to talk about the presence where they might not be wanted of homeless people as the problem. Can you talk about that distinction?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. Very often, cities don't know what to do about homelessness. And they try to respond to community members' concerns about public safety or concerns about how a city might appear to tourists, business concerns, et cetera, with actions that simply move homeless people around or criminalize behaviors that would be absolutely normal for someone who is not homeless. So, for example, cities institute laws against sitting on sidewalks in particular spaces to discourage homeless people from being in downtown areas. Madison was experimenting with laws like this for quite a while. I don't know whether it is still the case. Laws like this and other laws that make it illegal to share food with homeless people in public places, etc., are all tactics to manage where homeless people are in a city. These give off the message to the general public that homeless people are undesirable, that they are unsightly, that there is something wrong with them being in public spaces. And that continues to feed these narratives that homeless people are unsafe or that they should not be around housed people. That's very different than crafting policy that actually gives housing to homeless people. And very often, cities are not doing both. They are choosing these policies that criminalize homelessness rather than investing in infrastructure that will keep people housed and rehouse people who have become homeless.
We are talking about how we talk about homelessness and people who are homeless with Whitney Gent, University of Nebraska Omaha Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Civic Engagement. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you see your own local community working on problems related to homelessness? Do you think it's a positive or negative the way that the issue is being handled? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into some of the different places where we might see rhetoric surrounding homelessness. And let's start with the news media, which I know covers a lot of ground. But what kind of things do you see in reporting about homelessness that concerns you?
Well, let's talk specifically about this case with the murder of Jordan Neely on the subway in New York. If you look at different forms of media framing around this story, it's very politically driven, right? So if you look at CNN, you see a story that tells you that Daniel Penny, the 24-year-old ex-Marine who put Neely in a chokehold, ought to be convicted, right? If you are reading the Fox News write-up of this story, you see Neely, this homeless man, portrayed in terms of his rap sheet, all of the things that he may have done incorrectly over time or illegally over time, and you literally get a beach shot of shirtless alleged murderer Daniel Penny in that same story. So we have a really clear villain and savior in this Fox News story. And the savior is the alleged murderer of this man on the subway. So we're seeing very politicized representation here. We are seeing the portrayal of a homeless person, again, as a criminal in this Fox News story. Neely, yes, committed a number of infractions in the city of New York. Daniel Penny, encountering him on the subway, however, could have had absolutely no idea that that was the case, right? Neely was behaving erratically on the subway, but Penny may have genuinely believed that he was protecting others, or that his chokehold of Neely was in self-defense. But he likely believed that not because he knew Neely, but because of the messages that he has likely consumed about the dangers of Black men, of homeless people, of people with mental illness through news media coverage and entertainment media coverage and the political messages of the city all around him.
And that gets,
so we're seeing real impacts.
Yeah, and I think that gets to part of your core concern, that the way the media and pop culture portrays homeless people might then influence the way people interact with people who are homeless in real life.
Absolutely. Yes.
We're talking to Whitney Gent, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Civic Engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Her research focuses on rhetorics of poverty and homelessness. We're talking about the ways that homelessness is portrayed in the news and popular culture, how that influences our opinions of people who are homeless. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see when you watch the news or a TV show, a movie, and homelessness is part of the story? How do you see homeless people represented there? Do you see a lot of homelessness in your community? How does your community handle that as an issue, or does it ignore it? If you've experienced homelessness yourself, how did people treat you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Whitney Gent, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Civic Engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Excuse me. She studies rhetorics of poverty and homelessness. A man who was homeless was killed on a New York City subway by a fellow passenger earlier this month. And we're talking with our guest about how our conversations around homelessness impact our real-world actions. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So it's a little bit rough, but about 8 years ago, I ended up homeless. I was married. My wife of 10 years has been a stay-at-home mom for most of it. Getting divorced, the divorce and, you know, the fighting for the kids cost over $130,000. And I ended up homeless, even though I had a good job. I was making decent money doing manufacturing. I'd work 4 days on, 3 days off, night shifts. And on the other three, when I was off, I had to stay on the same schedule. So I'd stay up at night and I'd walk around in the streets of Milwaukee because I had a car. And I'd pick up scrap metal and sort it in the back of my car and then take it in cash the next morning so that I could earn some extra money. And the cops would stop me lots of times, even though I had, you know, like bags, you know, so I'm picking up stuff in the street doing a public service. And I never was written a ticket, but it's just, you know, it's just astonishing to me because I was not on drugs. I was just, it was just a series of bad circumstances and I couldn't afford a place to live and pay child support and my attorney and, you know, alimony and all the rest of it.
And Marcus, when you think back on it, and thank you so much for being willing to share the story with us. I mean, do you think that you were what people thought about when they thought about a homeless person?
I don't know. I didn't feel seen most of the time. Just because, you know, like my clothes, my outer clothes were, my winter jacket was a little bit dirtier just because I'm picking up scrap metal. And yeah, people would just walk past me where, you know, I'd even say hi to them. I'm a pretty friendly person. And yeah, lots of times I got no response. So they pretend like they didn't hear me. And so it's a very strange and enlightening situation, sir.
Marcus, thank you so much again for being able to share, willing to share that with us. Professor Gent, I don't know, when we start to talk to people who are homeless, some of the stereotypes might break down. The stories might not be what we expect.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. And I appreciate Marcus sharing his story about feeling invisible, because my experience is that that is often the case with people who are living homeless. And I think that that is a further boon to the argument that I'm making about media representation. People have a tendency to ignore or not really see those who are experiencing homelessness around them, but to absorb instead these media representations of people experiencing homelessness that may not actually be accurate and that peddle in the kinds of damaging stereotypes that I have already mentioned. One way that we have seen this is a shift over time in Hollywood representations of homelessness. In the late 80s, early 90s, most of the films about homelessness actually were comedies that made fun of people who weren't trying to help people experiencing homelessness. As time has gone on, we have seen a shift towards seeing more depictions of homeless people as useless or as criminals. We have also seen a shift towards not comedy, but the sort of gritty drama where people overcome their homelessness through the help of someone who is housed, a sort of savior narrative. And very often it is a Black person experiencing homelessness who is helped out of that homelessness by someone who is white and housed. So the stories that we are seeing on our screens don't necessarily match the stories of the people who are actually in front of us experiencing homelessness when we pass them by, like Marcus is depicting.
Thanks for that call, Marcus. Nick joins us now in Green Bay. Nick, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Nick?
We're homeless right now. We're staying in a hotel. I got hurt at work, and I got fired, but they gave me a $5,000 to leave, and that was my only recourse, and we're homeless now because I lost everything because of the work accident. The only thing that I'm hoping for is that workers' comp is going to come in. Hopefully I get a nice settlement where we can buy our own house. But yeah, right now we're just living out of a hotel, and the people at the hotel are super nice. They like help us out as much as they can possibly, but it's just frustrating because my wife and I both work, but we don't make enough money to pay rent. We got three kids, so it's just really hard.
Nick, apart from hoping workers' comp comes through, like, is there something that you think, hey, this is something that could help us out, help connect us with a place to live, a permanent place to live that we can afford?
Nothing that I've found so far. And thank God my mom-in-law, because she's putting the hotel on her credit card. And I mean, we're just buying our time. We're working. We both work full time, but it just rent is ridiculous.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. I really appreciate it. Best to you and your family, and I hope you get through this soon. Professor Gent, can you talk about, you know, turning the conversation toward policies, solutions that might affect, that might help people in Nick's situation?
Absolutely. You know, first of all, I want to say that the situations that Marcus and Nick have just shared with us are not unusual in the population of people who have experienced homelessness. That, you know, earlier I was talking about the stereotypes or assumptions that everyone who's experiencing homelessness is either addicted to something or has made terrible choices that cause them to end up on the street or mentally ill. In neither of these cases do we find those things to be true. The assumptions that people make about homelessness are often obstacles to policymaking and often obstacles to the development of enough public will to cause politicians to pay attention to homelessness. So most of the time when cities are working to ameliorate issues related to homelessness, they're doing so out of a concern from a business community that having homeless people out in front of their storefronts will cause a decline in their business. This leads to the kind of policymaking that we were talking about before, where homeless people get shuffled around. If we have the political will to motivate politicians to create housing, to better understand why people are experiencing homelessness, then we are actually addressing the source of the problem related to homelessness, rather than peddling in stereotypes, or rather than addressing the problem for business owners, as opposed to for the people who are experiencing homelessness themselves.
Thanks again, Nick, for sharing your story with us. Talking to Whitney Gent from the University of Nebraska, Omaha, studies rhetoric and civic engagement there, looking at talking about the way we talk about homelessness and homeless people in the United States. Back to your calls now with Jan in Illinois. Jan, hello.
Hey, hi. The part that I came into the radio station talking about the killing in the subway, this homeless man, and in that instance, to me, homeless has nothing to do with it. The circumstances at the time was a violent, angry, scary individual threatening people, and people took it in their own hands to take him down because other scary, violent people have done this before. And so using homelessness in that case to like make him appear to be, oh, poor homeless man, and here we're mean to him, is baloney. I mean, it just is twisting the facts. And that's, and then you, and now you've made homelessness as a bad, you know, bad, awful people are all homeless. No, this guy, number one, was a career criminal. And then number two, he was violent at the time, and nobody knows, nobody in the subway knows anything about this other background issues. So, you know, it's like quit dragging homeless into those kind of situations. But
Jan, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Professor Gett, Jan saying maybe in this case, homelessness, the homeless status here shouldn't be at the center of the story. What do you think?
I think that we can't remove it from the center of the story, Rob. I disagree with Jan about the order of things. I believe that Daniel Penny saw Jordan Neely as a threat because of the ways that he has seen homelessness represented. Neely was not violent. He was speaking loudly. He was yelling and he was making threats. But there's no evidence that he exhibited any actually violent behavior. And even if he had exhibited actually violent behavior, I would argue that there was no need for that to result in his death, that the perception of Neely as violent comes from his identity as a homeless man and the ways that that all gets tied up in the New York subway, in his identity as a Black man, in mental illness, et cetera. So while I hear what Jan is saying and I hear her concern for not demonizing homeless people, I think that we cannot quite so easily separate those things.
Jan, thanks a lot for calling in. Professor Gent, could you steer us toward places where you think there are accurate or helpful depictions of homelessness, whether it's in media coverage or in your work looking at popular culture?
Yeah, I actually would point people toward the YouTube channel or website called Invisible People, which contains a series of interviews with people who are or have experienced homelessness. This allows our listeners to experience stories firsthand, as opposed to mediated representations where people have crafted stories that they think will be appealing to Hollywood audiences or the audiences who are streaming whatever content is created. It allows people to tell their own stories instead of having those stories shaped for audiences. And I think it's really crucial that we listen to stories from those perspectives.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Whitney Gent is an assistant professor of rhetoric and civic engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Her research focuses on rhetoric about poverty and homelessness. She joined us for a conversation about how we talk about homelessness and how that translates into real-world actions and sometimes policies. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, new legislation here in Wisconsin aims to tackle the PFAS problem in our water supply for communities around the state. We'll hear from one of the bill's sponsors and look at the wider problem. William Shakespeare's enduring popularity has led to a lot of theories, sometimes conspiracy theories, about who actually created his plays. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies. Plus, it's Friday. That means it's going to be Food Friday. We're going to get some great baking advice from a psychotherapist who also happens to be a master baker. We'll get actual practical advice in the kitchen, plus learn about the mental health benefits of baking bread and other baked goods. You can join in with your own stories right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, is it possible that a scoop of ice cream could be good for you every now and again? We'll find out what the science says from a public health historian and connect food research to health outcomes with a nutritionist. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at chronic student absenteeism during the pandemic and how it's still affecting schools today. First, suppose you want to eat right, healthy, and you want to know the best science behind the food you eat. But when you start to dig into things, the results of nutritional studies can seem confusing, maybe even contradictory. Is coffee good for our health or not? I hope so. Could a glass of red wine a day help keep the doctor away? The scientific consensus for a lot of questions like these isn't always clear. It's probably safe to assume that at least an apple a day won't hurt us. There's pretty solid evidence on fruits and veggies. But what if a nutritional study found that a daily dose of your favorite ice cream could provide some health benefits? On average, we eat more than 20 pounds of ice cream and frozen desserts every year. That's a lot of sugar and saturated fats. How is it possible there could be a health benefit to that? We're in Wisconsin. We might want it to be true. Our next guest reported on findings that suggest it might be true, but the idea has gotten a chilly reception from many researchers. We'll follow that story and then talk to a local registered dietitian nutritionist about how we can use what the science says about our food to make better health decisions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to follow what the science says about nutrition? Have you tried and given up? And with ice cream, how often do you eat it? Would you eat ice cream more if there really were a health benefit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Johns is a public health historian and a journalist. He recently wrote a piece in The Atlantic titled Nutrition Science's Most Preposterous Result. You can find a link to that story at WPR.org/Central Time. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
What started you down this ice cream trail, David?
Well, I got this funny tip from somebody kind of in the broader public health world that I was talking to for a completely different reason. That basically, a doctoral student at Harvard had hit upon this very surprising finding that consuming about a half cup of ice cream a day was associated with a reduced risk of heart problems among diabetics. And, you know, obviously this was like a very strange result, not exactly what a doctoral student was, you know, expecting to find. It was something that was met with a lot of skepticism by the kind of more senior scientists at Harvard School of Public Health there, one of the most influential nutrition departments in the country. But as I looked into it, and as I this was just sort of like funny for me at first, or this kind of curiosity. But as I dug into it, I discovered that actually there was this kind of puzzling paper trail in the scientific literature that went back a couple decades that other researchers had found this, where basically eating ice cream was associated with a lower risk of diabetes, which was just like too, you know, so surprising and such a curious thing that I had to dig in further and write about it.
As the scientists you talked to in writing this article looked into that, what did they do to try to figure out, okay, what's wrong with these numbers, which was, I think, their working assumption?
Yeah, at first they were like, okay, you know, there's random, weird, spurious results can pop up all the time in science. That's completely, you know, typical of scientific research. And in this case, the findings were based on large-scale observational epidemiology studies, which is where they basically start with a healthy population and they follow them over time. They keep track of what they eat based on dietary questionnaires, and they associate what, you know, what they're eating with various kinds of health outcomes. In this case, they were looking at, yeah, metabolic disease and diabetes. So at first they were like, okay, we got to just check the numbers. You know, maybe there was a data entry error. Maybe there was just something that we didn't, you know, we forgot to kind of, you know, check for some kind of confounding or some kind of bias that was in the data. But basically they did that and it all checked out. They tried all kinds of different ways for testing this particular dissertation finding that I'm describing, and they basically couldn't make it go away, right? So then they, you know, from there, as they dug into this question further, there were other kinds of explanations that they hit upon that they think might explain the finding in a way that doesn't suggest that ice cream is actually the cause of, you know, a reduced risk of diabetes. I can explain that further if you want me to.
Yeah, one of those reasons, as I understand it, and I've seen this and talked about on the air about alcohol, is the idea that, okay, if I'm getting less healthy, I might have cause to avoid foods that I think are unhealthy, like, say, ice cream. So that might be adding unhealthy people to the no ice cream side of the equation and skewing the results. How did scientists look at that part of the story?
Exactly. So this is a phenomenon called reverse causation. This is one possible explanation for how people kind of explain this ice cream finding. Like maybe the easiest way to think about reverse causation is, you know, in these studies, even though they're following people over time, they're not, the data that they're collecting is not super granular. So sometimes you can't tell whether the effect caused the disease or the disease caused the effect or the exposure rather. So like a really simple way of understanding this is, in the scientific literature, then there have been connections found between mouthwash use and mouth cancer. Right. So when these first popped up, people are like, maybe mouthwash causing mouth cancer. Actually, based on a little further digging, they discovered that no, people with mouth cancer were having bad breath. So they were using mouthwash. So it was the disease that was causing the exposure, not the exposure causing the disease. And as you said, the theory with regard to this ice cream stuff was basically like maybe some of the people were developing kind of like pre-diabetes. And so those people were either being told by their doctors or kind of of their own volition, like, you know, I got high cholesterol, I got high blood pressure. Maybe I need to cut back on, you know, a range of foods that they think of as unhealthy. So kind of the sick people or the people who were getting sick were cutting back on ice cream. So the only people who were left eating ice cream were the healthier people. So that might skew the data a little bit. There's, you know, but there's other explanations for how it could be, or it could be real.
Talking to David Johns about a piece in The Atlantic titled Nutrition Science's Most Preposterous Result, looking at the science and nutrition of ice cream. Now, David, another complicated thing is a lot of these reports you write are self-reported. You might ask me, Rob, how much ice cream actually is frozen custard? How much frozen custard did you eat yesterday? Oh, a couple scoops. Well, Rob, scoops are pretty big, right? Like how we report how much we eat might skew the data.
Exactly. So these the data here are based on what they call food frequency questionnaires. So it's basically you ask people how often you eat specific foods, and they only collect these, you know, every 4 years on average, in a bunch of these studies, that's the case. So yeah, you know, if you ask people what they eat, generally these types of questionnaires of, you know, I don't know, there's been some criticism of them in general with the scientific literature, but they do a pretty good job of kind of ranking foods that you eat versus don't eat and kind of how frequently you eat them. So like, you know, if you eat yogurt, you know, if you're a person who eats raisins, you know, and that can give a sort of rank order. But in terms of like how much you eat of them. So like you said, with regard to ice cream, there's a tendency to say that you eat healthy foods more often than you do, and to say, well, yeah, you know, I didn't eat that whole tub of, you know, you're probably not going to report that you ate a whole tub of or a whole pint of, you know, Ben and Jerry's in front of the television when, you know, and you're going to say, well, yeah, I had a, you know, a small bowl, whatever. So that can skew the data.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm an ice cream eater. I have been my whole life, and I'm up there. So one thing that we know, though, that got handed down, like, from grandparents to, you know, great-grandparents and all the way up, is that you have a glass of cold water when you have ice cream, because that helps to thin it out in your digestive system. Then it's easier for your body to digest, but you still get the fun of ice cream. So it's that water that might be a factor. And I'm wondering if that showed up in any of the small print any of the documentation that your guest has been looking at.
Gail, I got to ask, do you get more brain freeze when you do that, ice cream and cold water?
Oh, no, but you really feel good when you're having the water, because you know that you have the ice cream and it's not going to be like having ice cream.
Gail, thanks for the call. David, I'm guessing the research didn't get this granular. I don't know if there's going to be anything to that water ice cream combo, but it points toward another complicating factor. Usually we don't just eat one food. There might be interactions between different things we consume at the same time. How does that get factored into research?
Yeah, I can't say I have heard of that
me
water
neither.
Theory. But, you know, I think that, you know, yeah, it could be a double dose of brain freeze there, but also could fill you up in some way, or at least temporarily. Yeah, and certainly in these studies, you know, they lump together all the ice creams, right? So it's not like, you know, they're not testing mint chocolate chip versus butter pecan versus, you know, it's just in these questionnaires, they just ask about ice cream. So there's a little, you know, you're looking through a kind of hazy lens there. But yeah, the other thing that in nutrition research that's very difficult is if you eat one food, that means you're basically not eating the other, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, you can't, you know, people talk about randomized trials where you're testing say a pharmaceutical, you can give people a placebo. So they're either getting a drug or they're not getting the drug. And so you can do a very precise test of like adding one thing and, you know, versus, you know, not having it in the diet. But with diet, there's always a kind of replacement aspect, which is just an added thing that makes nutrition science research so very difficult. So if you're eating ice cream, what does that mean you're not eating, right? You know, whatever that replacement food might also have an effect on your health, or presumably does have an effect on your health. So it's an additional complication to why these studies are so very hard.
Yeah, I don't want placebo ice cream. David, as we wrap up, has this changed your ice cream eating behavior?
It hasn't. I mean, I have to confess that I was an ice cream eater before I did this research, and I remain an ice cream eater afterwards. But I would say, you know, it's probably not cause for going and digging in the freezer thinking that it's going to, like, you know, protect you against diabetes. But, you know, my theory is that there probably are other good reasons for eating ice cream besides thinking about the health aspects.
David, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
That was David Johns, public health historian and journalist. He's got a piece in The Atlantic about the science and the research when it comes to the health impact of ice cream. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Up next, a Wisconsin nutritionist joins us to help us sort out all that health news and food news we see and sort it into our decision making. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel overwhelmed sometimes by news about what is and isn't good for us to eat? How do you sort through it? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're digging into the world of nutrition science and the connections between the food we eat, the health outcomes we can expect. Started with a public health historian who shared the scoop of a number of stories that found some possible health benefits to ice cream. Now, a nutritionist joins us with advice on how to evaluate the kind of food and health news we see and make good eating decisions. Breanne Thornton is a registered dietitian nutritionist at UW Health and UW Madison. Breanne, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm guessing as a nutritionist, you get questions from not just clients, but friends and others. Hey, should I eat blank? Is this healthy for me? Is this something that you hear all the time?
Yes, I commonly get questions from, you know, articles that people are reading or seeing online. And then I have to dive into the evidence to pick it apart and really understand the study that it's based on.
And then just talking to David just now, it seems really complicated in some cases to sort out the evidence. What did you think of his ice cream journey and what he shared there?
Yes, it is really difficult to pick apart the research that they're using to base these articles on. But I really think he had a great analysis that he shared with everyone. He talked about that it's an observational study, and observations don't always equal causation. And really, you know, the gold standard for evidence is a randomized clinical trial, which is difficult to do when you are studying nutrition and have maybe less funding for something like that.
I'm guessing there are some pretty solid nutritional guidelines out there. Like, I think we're always going to say that adding to our fruits and veggies is going to be good, and probably we're never going to benefit by eating more potato chips and soda, right?
Right. So we do know that ultra processed foods have negative impacts on our health, and the DASH diet and American Heart Association really have strong recommendations that are based on years of research, not just one study, that show decreasing intake of processed foods really is best for our health and more focused on those nutrient dense, less processed foods.
Now, how much of dietary advice is, you know, this is one size fits all, everybody can benefit from this, versus, hey, I'm a person with, you know, my own physical condition, maybe particular health conditions. How much is it helpful to individualize our diets?
It's really essential to individualize the diet. So we all have different genetics. We have different factors like age and gender that contribute to our health risk. And then we have multiple conditions to consider. So we can't just make one recommendation for all people for their heart if we're not considering their gut function or their blood sugars as well.
How do you, working with a client, how do you start to sort that out? When a patient has those conditions, what do you do to recommend particular diets?
I really look at the whole person. So I start with learning about them and what they typically like to eat during the day, their physical activity level and what they're able to do. And then we look at their health records. So we look at their labs and their blood pressure, and we figure out where is a place that we want to start. And really, we focus on one or two things to do, because if we try to do more than that, often it gets challenging and maybe not maintainable to do.
I wanted to ask about that in particular. Like, we might know what's good for us, but setting up habits that fit those good foods into our lives, or in my case, habits that cut those bad foods out of our lives, how do we start to make those changes?
Yeah, it really starts with what you're ready to work on. So if you know it's getting to be summer and it's easier for you to eat vegetables, let's focus on that. If exercise is hard for you right now because of joint pain, we don't need to focus on that right now. But I think starting with something that you're ready to work on and that feels realistic is really important when we're trying to think about health goals, and knowing that it can take about 12 weeks to establish a new habit.
How do we make that habit successful? How do we, you know, not just go to the grocery store one time, buy that new food, maybe let it rot in the fridge, maybe eat it, but actually get to that 12 weeks of habit forming?
It really takes a lot of support from other people in your home, and you have to think about your internal motivation. Sometimes that number on the scale feels like it's really important, but really it's that we want to live a long, healthy life, and we want to see someone in our family have an exciting milestone like a wedding or have a baby. So we have to think about those factors that are really important to us. And then again, starting small. So if we want to increase our vegetable intake, maybe just buying one vegetable that we know we like, prep it, wash it, and chop it, have it ready to go. And then, you know, you're adding it to one meal versus saying, I'm going to eat salad every day. That can feel a little daunting.
Now you, I see, specialize in nutrition and interstitial cystitis. Can you talk about what goes into understanding nutrition with a, you know, a very particular condition like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of root causes that happen with our health. And so we need to consider what is causing these issues. When we have high blood pressure, you know, it's not a medication will lower blood pressure, but it's not getting to what's causing it. And it's what's causing it is maybe lack of activity, stress, or you need to lower your sodium intake. So I really focus on getting to the root cause and looking at the person as a whole to help them make changes.
Sometimes in the news, we get the idea, okay, this food is bad, this food is good. Can you talk about, you know, just moderation? Maybe we're not going to go on the all ice cream diet, but maybe it's not a disaster if we have it every week or two.
Right. So the DASH diet does encourage us to limit our sweets, but basically not every day. Less than 5 times a week is really reasonable. And we also need to think about the portion, which I think he mentioned. So a half a cup of ice cream is actually something that the food labels have changed the portion size because that doesn't seem real reasonable. So most portions are 2/3 of a cup. So we want to think about how often we're having it and the portion. And we want to think about balance, because if we say we're never going to eat ice cream again, that's probably not going to happen. And then we end up overdoing it in the future. And then we move away from a healthy habit we were trying to stick to.
Now, when you see a new news story about a nutritional study that finds food X or drink X is surprisingly good for you or surprisingly bad for you, how do you read that? How do you try to figure out, hey, is this something that we need to take into consideration here, or is this just kind of a blip?
Yeah, I learn a lot from my patients. They tell me about new products coming on the market, and I look at the food label and kind of see if there's any research that has popped up on it. But it really takes a lot of critical analysis when we're looking at a specific food or a specific research study to make sure that we are understanding exactly what it is and not just reading between the lines or reading one line from a research study.
A lot of times emotion can be tied into our food choices, maybe moral judgment if we're eating a food that's bad for us. How much does that affect your patients?
I think especially over the last couple of years with everything that's been going on in the world, emotional eating is a concern for people, and food does make us feel good in the moment. But we need to understand if there's any other healthy ways that we can cope with that emotion. So I think that getting the right support from your provider, maybe a mental health provider, and just making sure that you are supported in all ways so that we're not turning to food always for comfort. Yes, it's celebration and yes, it's nourishment, but we want to have healthy ways to cope with emotions as well.
As we wrap up, Brianne, I'll ask you the same question I asked David earlier. Does hearing about this journey about ice cream research affect your decision to eat ice cream more, less, not at all?
I don't think it does. You know, this is an interesting consideration. I think that it really just reiterates the DASH diet saying that all foods fit in moderation. And I think if you want to go out for ice cream with your family in the summer, you should do it.
We'll leave it there, Brianne. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Brianne Thornton, registered dietitian nutritionist with UW Health and UW Madison. She joined us today to help us understand a little bit about nutritional science and the connections between what we eat and how it affects our health. We heard earlier from public health historian David Merritt Johns about his article in The Atlantic looking at scientific findings about the health impacts of eating ice cream and why it's so complicated in some cases to sort out, to connect a straight line between the food we eat and our overall health. Coming up after the news, we look at the numbers on chronic student and sometimes teacher absenteeism during the height of the pandemic and the data we've seen since then. And we're hoping to hear your stories, whether you're a student, a parent of a student, if you work in a school, what are you seeing when it comes to not seeing kids in the classroom? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.